And it's Joe, and joining me on the phone right now is British singer-songwriter Laura Marling. Hi, Laura.
Hi.
The new album that you released, absolutely brilliant.
Oh, thank you very much.
Yeah, it's just it's such a gorgeous listen, and especially in these times, but I want to start off asking you, why did you release it early?
Yeah, it seemed like, you know, the infinite pushback of the deadline would go on forever and ever. And I don't know. I mean, it seems like that might still be the case. And on instinct, it felt like that it might be a good time to listen to music or to release an album. And I think, you know, now that has been the case. I've been listening to albums in a way that I haven't done for a very long time. So, and it was all finished, you know, there was no reason really other than, you know, the usual stuff that people want to do a good job for you. But yeah, that's it really.
It's interesting that you say that, listening to albums and music where you're actually sitting and paying attention to everything that's coming out of the speakers.
Yeah, it's been I have to admit, it's been a really long time since I've done that. And, you know, here in London, you're allowed out to go for a walk for half an hour a day, which is kind of almost the perfect time to listen to a whole album. And it's been such a pleasure to do that. I don't, you know, and I don't really do that usually. Or if I do, it's filled with the kind of noise of the city, which there isn't any of at the moment.
This album, lyrically, sonically, just hit home with reflections on things that are missing, like good and bad. The one song that really stood out for me when I first heard it, with this crazy isolation and quarantine that we're all experiencing, Blow by Blow.
Hmm.
You say, sometimes the hardest thing to learn is what you get from what you lose.
Yeah. I mean, it's astonishing how different things are when read in the context of the time. That, you know, that's the kind of amazing thing about songwriting. I mean, I obviously nothing I could have ever imagined would have prophetically come up with this, but that is that.
I guess that's the other thing that struck me too with that, is that all of these songs were written prior to,
yeah,
all of this craziness. We could have never known this would happen, but I mean, everything about the album is just so poetic and brilliant.
Oh, thank you very much.
You co-produced this album. This is new for you, right?
It is. I've produced before. I produced my fifth record, and I didn't love the experience of producing on my own, so it was nice to have to co-produce with Ethan Johns and Dom Monk's engineer.
Mm-hmm.
But it was the first time actually I'd had a studio of my own. We didn't do the big bits of the recording in my studio because it's not very big. We did all the band live takes in a big proper studio. But what I think sort of contributed to my sort of vision, if you will, like audio vision for the album, was that I had my little space that I could make lots of weird noises in, specifically the choral arrangements, the backing vocal arrangements. Their backing vocals are the most embarrassing thing and pointless waste of time to do in an expensive studio. So I do think that's a product of having my own space. And then the strings were arranged by Rob Moose, who's just an extraordinarily talented human being.
Did you envision or hear the arrangements when you were thinking about the songs? Or is that something new? Is that something that he brought?
Oh, he brought that. I mean, the only instruction I gave him is where I thought that the strings should come in, which he didn't listen to. And I sent him these three tracks. He sent me back his work, and that was it. That's exactly how they ended up on the album. So to find, you know, it's what I'm quite, well, I'm not quite lucky. I've had to work quite hard to find these people. But when you do find people who you trust implicitly, you know, you're taking a bit of their incredible talent and having it augment part of your, you know, output. It's a really generous thing that they do. So he's one of those people.
Too. When I heard it too, the harmonies, I started researching. I'm like, who is doing these harmonies? And it's you.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah,
it's me really trying to exercise my range as hard as I can.
It's almost, as you said, choral, kind of angelic almost.
Oh, thank you. I'll take that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Now let's go on to the title track, Song for Our Daughter. These songs are written to a fictional daughter, correct?
Yes.
Do you think this is digging into a deeper feminine narrative for you?
Yeah, I think I'm sort of consistently preoccupied with a feminine narrative. And I think, you know, not all the songs were written as a kind of figurative letter to a daughter or a figurative whatever. But in, you know, when the album was finished and I realized what the kind of cohesive theme of it was, which is always a reflection of whatever I've been interested in or been thinking about, it has been, in the last couple of years, it's been what it is to sort of diplomatically conduct yourself as a woman in the world, because in reality, the world doesn't work always in the favor of femininity. And so how, you know, how do you develop a sense of diplomacy in order to deal with that? And that's and all the conflicts that come with that can be quite sort of against the grain of a sort of empathetic feminine sensibility. Not that, you know, mm-hmm. not that you are necessarily empathetic just because you're a woman. But, you know, in my life, I found that a really interesting phase, rite of passage to get through.
You were inspired by a book for this song too, right?
Yeah. I mean, there's a Maya Angelou book called Letter to My Daughter, which is this incredible sentiment, which I have absolutely, you know, taken on borrowed. But it's her collection of life experiences that contributed to how she and what she understood from them and how they contribute to how she conducts herself in the world. And she is referring to a figurative daughter. And I think even in the foreword to the book, she says, you know, this is for all my daughters. And there's something so gorgeous about that sort of sorority, you know, maternal, I don't know, all of the stuff that's involved in those words.
Moving on to Alexandra, the opening track, sticking with influences. Leonard Cohen's song, Alexandra Leaving. Say you wanted to, I don't want to put words in your mouth, to like take that song further?
I guess it was only kind of loosely a response to Alexandra Leaving. I sort of got fixated on the character of Alexandra and what it is to survive the passions of a great man. I since found out that actually his song was a response to a poem about Alexandra. So maybe Alexandra never existed really, or didn't exist in his life. But yeah, sort of continuing my preoccupation with the female experience, the sometimes dehumanizing experience of being projected on or passionately adored in a way that kind of only sees you as a facade. And I didn't actually give her a voice in the song. I just continued to ask the same questions that I was thinking about. What she might have done afterwards. Yeah.
It's one of those songs where you sit back and you just think whatever happened and you're urged to want to know.
Oh, well, good. I'm glad.
Lyrically, like on Strange Girl, Stay Low and Keep Brave, there's all these little gems, a little kind of, I don't know, sparks of hope.
Well, it's amazing what speaks to you given, you know, whatever you're feeling. To me, that you know, in all kind of culture, it's a really interesting thing. What stands out to you because of what you're experiencing, which is why I always slightly sidestep really going into detail about what songs are about, because I don't want to deny people of that experience. This is the perfect example of that. It's really wonderful.
I want to talk a little bit to you about Paul McCartney.
Oh, yeah.
Your newfound love for
my
Paul.
My guy, yeah. Yeah.
You also have a song on the album that was inspired by him.
Yeah, well, I think it's more that it sounds a little bit like Paul McCartney. I definitely was very late to the game, and I'm very ashamed to say that it took me a long time to be convinced. I mean, I knew he was a great songwriter, obviously, and he was my dad's favourite Beatle, or he is my dad's favourite Beatle. I was thrown a curveball by quite a lot of the Wings lyrics. I couldn't. I'm much more of a lyric person than I am a musical person, I guess. And I couldn't quite get my heart and soul into some of the Wings lyrics, but a friend of mine played me a song that he wrote about 5 years ago called Jenny Wren, which is one of the most extraordinary songs I've ever heard, in the vein of Blackbird and Yesterday and that kind of songwriting. But the song I ended up writing that sounded fairly similar to his stuff is actually, you know, it's on the cheesier side of Paul McCartney, I'd say, inspired. And it's the last track of the album. It's called For You, and it's only 2 minutes long, and it's quite kind of crudely recorded, and the sentiment's very sickly in a maybe a nice way.
Did you have a favorite Beatle? Do you?
I was always a Lennon. I didn't think it was. I thought people were trying to be cool when they said George Harrison. I thought people were trying to be weird when they said Ringo Starr. I was always Lennon, and I still am. But
we're on the phone right now with Laura Marling, who I believe you are. Are you in London right now?
Yes, I'm in my living room in London.
And she just released, thankfully, her seventh studio album, Song for Our Daughter. You worked with Robert Icke?
Yes, theatre director in London. Yes, and Robert's an extraordinary person, let alone director. That was quite an education in, I don't know, I think he'd probably hate it if I said language, but it was an education in language for me. And also the kind of how a well-orchestrated, a well-choreographed sentence can pack a big punch. So that was very interesting. That really contributed to my, how I think about songwriting and writing in general.
The lyrics, I don't know if it's the lyric, the way that you present them, but they seem to be more conveying points instead of like a typical story.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think I'm a product of all of the experiences that I've had in the last couple of years, but also moving out of when you're younger, I think you have this kind of sense of being the center of your own movie. So everything's got this kind of narrative quality to it. And that's wonderful. Everyone should go through that and experience that and have this kind of, I don't know, magical experience. But then as you get older, you realize that it's full of these nuanced experience and full of, you know, it's constantly being interwoven with the interior narratives of other people's lives and what they feel and think. And I think that stops me from thinking about fantastical stories anymore. It's more kind of about the interior worlds of people.
You were just a teenager when you released your first album.
Yeah, I was 17.
So there's been a lot of growth.
Yeah, I'm a full adult now. Well, whenever I say that, I'm very quickly reminded that I'm not. But I certainly feel it.
When you also took this break, you had a side project.
Yes.
With Mike Lindsay.
Yeah, it's my favorite thing I've ever done, actually. I mean, I'm proud of all of my solo stuff, but Lump is just, it's called Lump, the side project, named by my friend who's 6 years old. So, and Lump is like a bizarre, Mike Lindsay's a producer and a musician, quite well known here. And he had just made this incredible sort of sonic landscape, as he called it. And he wanted me to come and help him carve it out and write lyrics and melody over the top of it. And the condition was that I only had sort of 5 minutes to do it for each song, essentially. And we came out after 4 or 5 days with this absolutely bizarre album and that seemed to make some sense. I mean, it's all just like random nonsense lyrics and seemed to have some kind of, I don't know, sort of slightly profound message underneath it all, which is interesting. And so we did that and released that. We did a little tour of the UK and some festivals and stuff. And then we actually, in the time that I've had off between these two albums, or between the last two albums, we've made another Lump record, which is also coming out later on in the year. So Lump lives on.
Lump lives on. You also did a little bit of work with Ed O'Brien from Radiohead.
Yes. Yes, I did. Gosh, I have been busy.
You have been very busy. I mean, there's still so much that you've been doing that it's like unbelievable.
You know, Ed called me sort of out of the blue and said that he wanted to put this sort of dream team together. Unfortunately, I was actually, I think, too busy to be part of the full-time dream team. And it was a dream team of people that he was working with. And I ended up only singing on one song, I think, though we worked on some other things together. I don't know. It was really special to be part of it. He's a really special person.
How long did it take you for this album, Song for Our Daughter? Are these songs that you've had, or are these all brand new songs that within the past 3 years you put together?
Yeah, they're all from the past 3 years. I mean, there was a couple written at the beginning, you know, as soon as Semper Femina, it always happens as soon as the last album comes out, the gate gets lifted, ready to start the writing of the next one. And as soon as Semper Femina came out, there was a couple of songs that just felt like hangovers of Semper Femina that came out. And then a couple of songs that we recorded for this album that I didn't end up using, which I listened to the other day, and I realized that actually they make the most sense to me about, you know, in the vein of an album written to a, you know, written to a younger generation.
The ironic part of this is that you would have been touring in our area.
I know.
This time.
I know.
When did you stop touring?
I just made it back from, we were in New Zealand the day that they sort of, New Zealand brought in a mandatory 2-week quarantine for anybody entering the country. And so we decided it was probably time to get on the plane and put an end to the tour. And we did. We just made it back in time for British lockdown. And I was supposed to fly straight from New Zealand to the States for 2 months. So that's a real shame.
Any idea of reschedule?
I mean, I see people rescheduling stuff for November. I think that's incredibly ambitious. Maybe it'll be fine, but I don't think it's going to be this side of the year. But as soon as I'm able, I mean, touring is my favorite thing.
For what reason?
Well, I guess I love to be on tour solo because it's like the perfect life for me. It's very structured and ordered. I don't know, maybe it's a bit of a sort of infantilized thing that you know where you're supposed to be. Somebody tells you where you're supposed to be, and it's usually at 5 o'clock every day, so you've got the whole day to do, you know, whatever you want. And usually that for me on tour involves like finding a library or a coffee shop or an art gallery or whatever and just planting yourself there for the day. And that's been my life. It's sort of just the life that I know the best, I think, though this has been the longest time that I've not been on tour, so maybe it'll be a different experience.
Well, I can't wait until we're out of lockdown and music is live again. And until that point, thank you for releasing song for our daughter, really, for We Have a Gift while we're doing this isolation.
Oh, that's very kind. Well, thank you. I'm glad you're enjoying it.